Let's catch up on the Wintrust Business Lunch, produced by Pete Zimmerman. Hi, it's John Williams. We're here until 1 o'clock. Then Anna Devlatis comes your way. Let's catch up with Tom Gimbel, who frequently joins us on the Business Lunch, the founder and CEO of the LaSalle Network, thelasallenetwork.com. Tom, welcome back.
Always good to be with you, John Williams.
I wanted to talk a little bit about what continues to be, it looks like, a K-shaped recovery, not just for the economy. Well, I guess when we talk about that, we're talking about individuals. But in the last year, some paychecks went up, some went down, right?
There's no doubt about it. But I would say overall, you know, more seemed to go up and others went away. And I think that's really more of the dynamic, as we talk about pretty much every week, is the jobs that have gone away are those hospitality jobs, and they just couldn't convert over to white-collar jobs.
It's an interesting way to put it. I mean, sure, some people are making less, but some people aren't working and may not go back, although you have to believe that those jobs will return, don't you?
They're returning already. I mean, I think we're already seeing that. And when you add almost a million jobs last month, and with the weather getting warmer, and the vaccinations being in wide distribution, that they are going to come back. And we'll see those numbers continue to get better in the April numbers, May and June. I think we'll be really excited about that.
I wonder if the boomerang will be such that they make up for lost ground. Do you think the wages for those positions will increase, or there'll be more earning opportunity for people who are in the hospitality industry compared to, say, before the pandemic?
No, I don't think so. I mean, they're tip-based jobs, so people are still going to be heavily influenced by what the gratuities are going to be by people that are frequenting. Now, I do think that we're going to continue to see more people going to the restaurants because of pent-up demand from not eating out, and so that'll increase it. But where you're still going to get hurt, and I was just talking to a group of restaurateurs the other day about this, is that until you can get people shoulder-to-shoulder in bars, you're going to be still losing some money there. So we'll get a lot of those jobs back, but the overall money won't be the same until the vaccines, or everybody's got one who wants one, and you're seeing a decline in the number of cases of COVID.
Speaking of the job market, I know some young people that are getting their degrees and venturing out into a world of who knows what opportunity. Can you talk about 2021 graduates, what the market is like for them? What questions should they be asking? Maybe now is not the time to be picky. Yeah, what advice do you have for them?
So I'd say it's a tale of two cities, really. Number one, it is an unbelievable time to be getting out of college. I mean, between now and a year ago, it's night and day from the opportunities that exist when companies are hiring like I haven't seen in 25 years. On the flip side, onboarding and orientation and actually learning how to do the job is harder than ever because so much of it is still virtual, and that's a disadvantage for the recent college graduates. So the big question I would ask if I'm a recent college graduate is, can you tell me about how the training and onboarding program is today and how that differs versus if it were 2 years ago when things were normal, and where you think there's a gap?
Are you suggesting that's a question a job applicant ask the employer? What sort of onboarding program do you have for me?
Yeah, to really find out. And if someone said, you know, because I might preface it by saying, I realize that I may be coming in at a disadvantage compared to somebody 2 years ago who was in the office. So I'm curious where you think those gaps are, and is there anything I can do on my own to expedite my learning curve while being at home?
Well, there you go. I mean, it sounds a little presumptuous, like, what are you going to do for me? But maybe that shows a certain awareness that you'd like a job candidate to have.
Yeah, it's really more about, I want to be the best employee I can be for you, and is there a training program? How do I go about learning? And quite frankly, where are you as my employer worried about me catching on and learning? And what can I do on my own to close that gap?
And then one last thing we got to run here, Tom, but hiring managers, what's the flip side of that? Do you have any advice for people that are looking for candidates? Anything they need to especially be aware of coming out of the pandemic?
Yeah, there's two sides of managers that we're looking at here, John. And number one is, you know, tell me what you were doing during the pandemic. If you weren't in school, what were you doing? Did you get in shape? Did you build a new patio at your parents' house? You know, what were you doing? Did you take master class? What types of things did you do to improve yourself? And the other is, And I hadn't even thought about this that much, but I was talking to a manager the other day who oversees a 50-person sales team, and they said, you know what? If I were a junior in college, I think I would have taken the time off and really just messed around and then be ready to work. And so if somebody can give me that answer and say, you know what, I knew that for the rest of my life I had to work, and I enjoyed my time, I hung out with my family, and now I'm ready to grind it out for you, then maybe that's not a bad answer, too. And it really comes down to the EQ level of knowing who you're interviewing with.
No kidding. Tom Gimbel, founder and CEO of LaSalle Network, thelasallenetwork.com. Thanks, Tom. We'll visit again.
Stay healthy.
That's the idea. Aidan Moatz, our next guest, co-founder and CEO of a company called Hazel Technologies, which is an ag tech startup. You may or may not have noticed that they recently announced that they had closed on a $70 million Series C round of financing, bringing their total funding up to $87 million. So what's all the buzz about? Why are people interested in this company? Aidan, you're on WGN. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me.
Congratulations for that. I'm really intrigued by what you all do, which extends the life of produce, right, of food.
That is correct. Yeah, we make products and technologies that allow us to control key physiological processes like the aging process and the spread of things like microbes and disease. We can target those technologies at specific challenges in perishable shelf life, and we can extend quality and extend shelf life and improve quality.
Give me an example.
Well, one of our flagship products, very popular, is something that we call an in-box sachet. It's about the size and shape of a sugar packet, give or take, and we consider it to be a packaging material insert. To use it, a customer on their packing line or in their field simply takes it out of the bag and throws it into a conventional pack of fruit or vegetable. And inside that sachet is a proprietary material that we have created to be able to store and time release a vapor phase active ingredient into the storage atmosphere of that box of food. In this case, the technology I'm referring to is one that we call an ethylene inhibitor. So for those of us that aren't up in our biochemistry, ethylene is a gaseous aging hormone that most fruits and vegetables produce during their aging process. It also triggers deleterious effects in shelf life, so things like loss of color, loss of quality, increased susceptibility to disease, and so forth. In the presence of a very small atmospheric concentration of this ethylene inhibitor, we're actually able to stop the produce response to ethylene entirely. That lets us take control of its metabolism, and in doing so, we can control its breathing rate, we can control water loss, and ultimately extend shelf life to the maximum duration during the storage and transit process. So it's all non-contact atmospheric chemistry, no residue, nothing sprayed, coated, or dipped on the fruits or vegetables. But by using this sort of biomimicry of the natural atmosphere, we can do a lot of good and help prevent food waste.
Yeah, I knew that. Well, so then this little packet then will, like you said, emit a vapor that, I guess, surrounds, what, bananas, broccoli, things like that? And what would the difference be between the shelf life, if you will, of those things with or without your product?
Yeah, well, we generally see about a threefold extension of shelf life during the storage and transit processes. And that can be on the order of weeks to months, depending on exactly what kind of thing you're talking about. But I think what might be a little bit more exciting even than that is, because we have this ability to regulate the physiology of these crops, we're actually extending shelf life beyond the retail shelf as well. And so there's a whole phase of the fruit and vegetable life cycle in which, the consumer wants to have a ripe thing to eat. And we're giving the consumers somewhere on average between 3 and 5 extra days of shelf life after the purchase of that piece of fruit or vegetable.
Does it affect the nutritional value or the flavor of the food?
So, no, there's no impact on flavor. And as far as nutritional value goes, I'm gonna caveat myself a bit to say that, my company doesn't do health studies in and of itself. But the active ingredients that we work with are quite well studied by quite a number of labs all over the world. And I think one thing that's really interesting about our application is that because we're slowing down metabolism, we're actually increasing, or I should rather say, we're actually retaining more of the healthful components of those fruits and vegetables from the point of harvest to the point of consumption.
Okay, I got an idea for you. Make an aerosol maybe a spritzer that when I get the bananas home, I can spritz them when they get to the ripeness I like, and it'll stay in that state for a longer period of time. You like my idea?
See, John, you're more prescient than you know, because within the next year or two, we'll be actually be releasing a consumer product for household use.
And would it do something like that for peaches and apples and whatnot?
Absolutely. In fact, you mentioned the banana use case, and I think that's one that I'm very excited about. We you know, sort of behind the curtain in our analytical facilities, we've discovered that we can utilize our technology and extend the shelf life of even a ripe banana, you know, a yellow, ready-to-eat banana, by as much as 10 to 14 days. So no more bad bananas.
You wouldn't do this for meats, would you? This would just be for produce?
Well, you know, again, with the prescient questions, we are moving into our first non-crop uses this year. One of our technologies is a broad-spectrum antimicrobial technology that, again, it's sort of a vapor phase release system. It can integrate directly into conventional pad-type packaging. And we're actually launching a couple of commercial pilots this year in the cut protein sector. So fish, pork, beef, I think. And hopefully that product will be fully live by the end of the year.
So I have, you know, sometimes we buy products. I'm trying to think of what they are. Is it shoes or something I would get in a box? But anyway, I would see a tiny little packet of something, and I never knew what that was. Is whatever that was akin to what you're doing here?
Kind of the two sides of the same coin, if you think about it. So what you're referring to is a silica gel desiccant. Desiccant, of course, being the technical word for something that absorbs moisture out of the atmosphere. And in shoes, you know, what that's intended to do is prevent your shoes from mildewing due to the presence of water. So what our technology does rather than absorb is actually emit a new bioactive into that atmosphere, whether it's, you know, our antimicrobial products or whether it's our ethylene inhibition products or any of our others. And that bioactive is targeted at a specific shelf life challenge in that specific perishable food. But we're adding to the atmosphere rather than subtracting from the atmosphere.
Understood. And who's buying your product then? Would it be the California fruit growers, or is it Jewel Osco that wants to not have to throw away produce, or is it restaurants maybe that want to extend the life?
You know, I'll answer the last one first. We have not been active in the food service industry, but on a going forward basis, you know, as we approach new market segments, food service is very much one of the ones that we intend to be targeting products for. You know, we work with a number of different customers from sort of the supply side all the way through to the retailer. You know, we serve currently about 160 clients in about 12 countries. A lot of them are what we call grower packers. And so you sort of said, hey, you know, California growers. Yep, we got a lot of them, you know, as big customers of ours. But there's also some distribution entities and a rising amount of interest among the retailers because we have kind of a unique ability to fix supply chains between our knowledge of working on the supply side and our knowledge of delivering high quality post-retail food to the retailers. So we got a few of those in our customers as well.
I like the idea of a little spritz by my plate of bananas and oranges. We got this two-stack tier of you know, fruits and vegetables in our kitchen, and if when we unpack our groceries, we just went spritz, and it didn't affect the taste, and there were no deleterious chemicals that I'm consuming, and it didn't affect the nutritional value. You get all those boxes checked, and I'm going to start spritzing.
I can confirm we can do all those things for you, John.
Well, good luck to y'all. So you guys are based in Chicago then, huh?
We are, yeah. I mean, we're definitely growing our international presence, and we've had a few employees already positioned on the West Coast and the Pacific Northwest and so forth, but the lion's share of our operations are located here in Chicago.
Wonder if that would work at RJ Grunt's. They've got that famous salad bar, and I wonder if they could. Why are you laughing? I've been nothing but help to you today, and it would sort of mist the salad bar with this. Of course, that's the ingredients in a salad bar aren't going to be there for days. We don't need to worry about that, right?
Well, you hope not. You hope not. But, you know, at the same time, you know, all food service, retail distribution sort of revolves around the concept of high turnover. Yeah. But that doesn't mean there aren't exigencies in the supply chain. And sometimes things go awry and sometimes stuff sits around. And it seems unlikely that it would ever be used kind of on the salad bar itself. But who knows how many boxes of stuff they got sitting in the back room that need to be spritzed up.
Aidan Moat is my partner. He's also the co-founder and CEO of a company called Hazel Technologies, hazeltechnologies.com. Fascinating. Good luck to you, Aiden. And let's visit again down the road when new products come out from you all.
Sounds great. Give me a ring whenever. And appreciate all of the rich intellectual property you've generated for me.
Look, I could do more than sell a produce enhancer, eh? Okay, we'll continue now. This is WGN. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch. Pete Zimmerman's the producer. This is John Williams. We always enjoy the conversation of Philip Weiss, president of Seyfarth at Work. He joins us again on WGN. Philip, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, John.
Let's talk. I'm a little curious, though, as to why you are interested in talking about this Uber story. Are they being sued for not picking up a blind rider? Am I reading that correctly?
That's right. In fact, an arbitrator, which basically is a judge of sort, ruled just last month that Uber was required to pay over $1 million to a rider who was blind because the accusation was this rider had been denied rides 14 different times from a number of different drivers. And while there's a lot of complexity to the case, there's transportation standards. It happened in California, which has unique laws. Really, this is kind of a bellwether for us because, John, we've seen million-plus dollar judgments for disability cases when it comes to employees who may have been fired or mistreated. But this is a customer here. And what we're also seeing, which is quite dramatic, is with the rollout of vaccines, with the reopening of businesses, many customers with disabilities are now coming out of self-imposed quarantine, going back to shops, restaurants, and using all kinds of public services. And it's the stores and the businesses that are not ready to serve them. So this risk is larger than one case.
Wonder what the particulars were. We don't have to dwell on it, but we're not asking the blind person to drive. It would seem to me like they could sit in the vehicle. You could take them where they need to go. If they can hail an Uber, why would an Uber driver deny them the ride?
Yeah, and that's, I'm sure, what the arbitrator was asking in one form or another. In this case, the rider had a service animal, a guide dog, with him, and that may have been one of the reasons, yep. But the reality is, the law is pretty clear that any business that you or I open is required to offer services equally to people who are or are not disabled. So the reality is, if the animal is there to allow the person to access the services, they should be accessing the ride equally. And that's where one of those confusing aspects of the case comes in. But really, it applies to anybody with any disability as well as any business at all.
Something like this happened at a bakery in the Midwest, too, right?
Yeah, and that's a really interesting connection. That case happened, John, not long after the recession of 2008-2009. And so there are some parallels, because a lot of businesses were so hell-bent on reopening, recapturing the market, rebuilding their lost revenue, is they put to the side other requirements that had been of greater importance in the past. And one of those requirements we were seeing, John, was equally serving and respectfully treating customers with disabilities. So in the case of this bakery, and this is quite similar, a woman came in with a guide dog who was blind, and the day was particularly busy, and the person behind the counter got a little flustered, refused to read the price tags or the price markings for the different bakery items to this person who could not read them herself, and also told her that we're going to have to take that dog and put it outside because I got enough kids in here making noise. It's too much for me. Both of which were obviously legally risky and the wrong decision from a business standpoint. And they ended up having to settle, pay big dough, so to speak, for those mistakes. So these are not unique incidents. But at a time like this, when people are focused on getting the business back, that business includes the disability community.
Hmm. This is a tangent because it's not about disabled people, Philip, but I was at a bar the other day and I counted 13 people and 5 dogs. And I remember pre-pandemic when we were all going about our days any way we wanted, we were having a series of conversations about how annoyed some people get when they see dogs that aren't service animals in grocery stores and restaurants. Do you have anything to say about the right and wrong of all of that?
Yeah, so this is an area that I think we're going to see a lot more focus on because of a couple of issues. Number one, people's nerves are a little more fraught as they come out of quarantine, self-imposed exile, so to speak. And so when something is not what they expected, there tends to be a bit of a knee-jerk reaction. What's interesting about animals and businesses is so long as you don't have an issue with someone working for you who may be highly allergic, it's never a bad policy to be as inclusive as possible. The line comes in when the dog or the animal creates a disruption, when the dog or the animal is not well-trained. So those rules apply across the board, but beyond that, the more people you include in a safe, responsible way, the better. So we'll see more talk about it, but something to think about.
And I don't think you and I are going to agree on that, because it would seem to me like, while it might be safe, if you are responsible to me, the non-dog customer at the restaurant, you would not have a dog in the restaurant. I mean, what about my rights or my experience?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of issues that I think come head-to-head here. There are environments where you've got people coming in who are concerned about hygiene and cleanliness. And whether that concern is legitimate or not, we want to take that into consideration. We have environments such as healthcare settings where you want to have all kinds of rules given safety needs. So you do want to look at your business operations. You do want to look at your customer base. You do want to look at safety and hygiene. But if you can check those boxes, you may want to operate with a bit of a freer hand. There's no question that whether you invite pets in or not is entirely the business's choice, including in something like rideshare. You can have, there's an encouragement to include people who have pets. It's not required. So it's totally different than this ADA, disability service animal question. So I think we'll see a focus on it, and you do want to look at the environment, and then you want to make a good business choice.
Philip Weiss, he's the president at Seyfarth at Work. Visit Seyfarth.com. That's S-E-Y. F-A-R-T-H, Seyfarth.com. Thanks, Philip. Let's talk again.
Great. Thanks for having me.
It's always a pleasure to talk to him. It's 1243. I would say the same about the Wintrust Business Minute. This is Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. The downtown Chicago office vacancy rate has set another record. Commercial real estate services firm CBRE says the vacancy rate rose to a record high 18.6% at the end of March. This follows the worst quarter of downtown office demand in 11 years and an 18% vacancy rate at the end of 2020. This is the highest share of empty office space downtown in the 14 years of available data from CBRE. While some companies plan to return to offices later this year, there's still concern over the long-term effect on office demand in Chicago. The University of Illinois and the Discovery Partners Institute are launching a teaching endorsement in computer science. The goal is to prepare more tech teachers. The initiative aims to address the shortage of qualified computer science teachers across Illinois. A new law in Illinois requires Illinois school districts to offer at least one computer science course by 2022-2023. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
More from Steve Alexander.
Yeah, it's always a good day when we get to mention the Big O's name. And part of the Orion Samuelson story, and I know you know this, John, is that he says he owes his legendary broadcasting career in part to competing in FFA speaking contests in high school.
Yeah.
Time's running out for future Big O's to compete in the 2021 essay contest. Allison Wadig is marketing specialist for Culver's Restaurants, which is the sponsor.
The FFA essay contest gives FFA members a chance to either write an essay or provide a video around a prompt. This year, it's really about the lessons of the agriculture industry and what we learned from the COVID-19 pandemic, and then how they can use those lessons to create a more sustainable future.
There are cash prizes.
They can win up to $7,500 to support their local FFA chapter.
The deadline to enter is next Monday, and you can get the scoop at culvers.com/essay contest. Culver's has a long history of supporting agriculture.
The relationships that co-founder Craig Culver and Lee Culver had with farmers that were in the local area just continued on as we grew.
And grow they did. Today, Culver's has nearly 800 family-owned and operated restaurants in 25 states, and their Thank You Farmers project has raised $3 million $1 billion to support agricultural education. Another big fundraiser is coming up on May 6th. Scoops of Thanks Day will feature $1 scoops of frozen custard.
So they can enjoy vanilla, chocolate, or the flavor of the day. This year will be mooey gooey twist.
Mooey gooey. Love that. All of the proceeds go to local agriculture education. Double digits again at the Chicago Board of Trade today. Corn right now is up 12 cents at 581. Beans are up 9.5 at 1391. And wheat is trading about 3.75 cents higher at 632. Soybean oil is up 3%. Lumber is up 2.25%. From the farm to your belly today, we celebrate National Peach Cobbler Day. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Amy Guth joins us. Let's talk about consumer prices. Which direction are they going? I think I know.
Yeah, your guess is probably spot on, and that is consumer prices are up. They have climbed in March by the most in nearly 9 years. That is, part of that is a little bit of a rebound in travel, commuting, that's kind of pushing up the cost of gasoline and car rentals, things like that. So it increased 0.6% from the prior month after a little bit of a gain, 0.4% in February. That's according to Labor Department data that just came out today. The jump in the cost of gas alone, though, accounted for about half of the overall March advance. So that's the role that gasoline plays in our lives. So it's really interesting to watch that. There's a lot of conversation going on from various industry watchers and economists about what is the state of things that we're in.
Stay right there, Amy. We want to hear what you have to say. We're not hearing it as well as we'd like to. So let's just pause on Amy Guth, and we'll pick up this conversation in just a second about consumer prices advancing by the most in nearly 9 years. Am I hearing that correctly?
Can I add something to that?
Please do.
And to what Amy was saying, the comparisons that we're going to start seeing from what we just saw with this consumer price index on through every other comparison to at this time last year is going to be phenomenal, because last year the economy was going in the tank.
Yeah.
Gasoline prices, as an example, dropped precipitously last year at this time, and now we're comparing the rise this year compared to what happened last year.
Let's see if we can join Amy again here. Amy, I'll bet we'll hear you better now. Go right ahead.
There we go. I think that Steve just said exactly what I was going to say, and that is part of the issue is comparing this time last year to this month's numbers, because we saw such dramatic drops and the role that gasoline plays in that when really nobody.
Let's continue to have this conversation, Amy, and if I say goodbye earlier than normal, you'll understand why. Talk to me a little bit about Blackstone Hotel. I'm kind of intrigued by this one, too, on South Michigan Avenue.
Yeah, so the Blackstone Hotel has been put up for sale, and this could be a really interesting test to really, show investor confidence right now. We saw three big hotel moves right on Michigan Avenue just in the last week. So by putting this historic hotel up for sale, it's really going to test that market and test the investor appetite for downtown hotels. In a moment when, we've seen the hotel industry just impacted so badly by the pandemic.
What's a hotel go for these days?
Well, I think there was a lot of speculation that there was going to be a lot of bargains, and it's really not quite the case. So we'll see about this one in particular. There is a $52 million loan, however, tied to this property that matured on June 1st, according to the property records. And so the owners need to either resell the hotel or sell the hotel, refinance before then. So I think that's going to be the big thing to watch in terms of what kind of price they get for it, what they do with that debt, et cetera.
Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thank you, Amy. I know you put a lot of work into this. I'm sorry that the connection isn't so good today. I'll just continue with the story that she is reporting on. Downtown hoteliers, and this is also a story that I'm referencing in ChicagoBusiness.com, are hoping pent-up demand for leisure travel leads to a strong summer tourism season as more people get the COVID-19 vaccines. How is that not true? How is that not going to happen, right? Some managers report bookings have ticked up recently, a badly needed positive sign after downtown hotels that were open and averaged 27% occupancy in 2020. Well, this is what Steve Alexander's been referencing, too. Of course, every metric this year, this spring, say, and summer, is going to be way up compared to last year, right? They were down 74% 2020 from 2019. So they fell off 74%, according to data from the research firm STR, nicknamed the Hotel of Presidents for the dozen U.S. presidents who have stayed at the Blackstone Hotel. It originally opened in 1910, was designated a Chicago landmark in 1998. And in my mind, I'm trying to place exactly what that one looks like now on South Michigan Avenue, 600 South Mish. So that would be across from Millennium Park or Grant Park.
Yeah, it's down in that area close to the Hilton, you know, the big old Hilton down there.
Right.
In that same neighborhood.
The hotel. Oh, really? Oh, that's right, because the Hilton is 720 South Michigan Avenue, now that you mention it. That's where the Cubs convention usually is. That's where we have hosted events many, many times here at WGN. The hotel is tied to the political expression of a smoke-filled room to describe behind-the-scenes deal-making of a 1920 meeting there among cigar-smoking U.S. senators to arrange the nomination of Warren Harding for president. $47 million, a Sage Venture, that's capital S, a Sage Venture, bought the Beaux-Arts building in 2005 before renovating the property with a $128 million overhaul, fueled in part by more than $47 million in tax credits. Okay.
So what's the connection to the word Blackstone? The smoke from the cigars made the stone black?
The hotel is also tied to the political expression of a smoke-filled room. Unless there's something dark about the deal-making, maybe they literally meant that the room was getting black because of all of the cigar smoke. Okay. And then just one other story to pass along here that Amy was going to touch on as well. She was talking about consumer prices and the direction those are going, advancing by almost... advancing by the most in nearly 9 years. So to your point, Steve, of course it goes up over the last 12 months, but this recovery is so robust that it's going quicker than anything we've seen in a very long time. That's encouraging.
Mm-hmm. It is, but again, keep in mind what you're comparing it to, where we were last year.
Yeah, no kidding. But I guess I think the point that I'm trying to make, I'm nuancing a story that Amy gave us, so I'm not expert on this, is that, of course, you would expect it to be better than last year. Would you expect it to be better than the 10 previous, right? And I guess it would have to be, right? Because the increments for the previous 9 years would have been incremental. Now you've got this huge increase just based on how that tells us as much about how bad it was, I guess, as how good it is now. That's the point you're making.
Yeah, I suppose the better comparison would be not to last year, but to 2019.
I wonder if we're going to start doing that, because I have not heard it done that way that often. And that does seem to be a more relevant comparison. It's 12:57. Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Amy. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Pete.